Good morning and welcome to The Morning Voice. I am Ed Ackerley, and this is where we talk about business success, organization success, and a little bit of Wonder, University of Arizona Wonder on our second hour, 8 o'clock hour. We'll be talking about Wonder. Three events last night. Oh my goodness gracious. Went to the Francisco Franklin History of Mexico and 50 Small Paintings at Jane's Place, Jane Hamilton Fine Art Gallery. What a wonderful, wonderful event and wonderful people. And Francisco was there. Of course, he was on the show last week and got to see his beautiful artwork, and he got to interact with. There was a lot of people there. It was amazing how many people were there, and it was fantastic. Got to see Morgan Murphy, who I haven't seen for a couple of days. She was our CEO and
the Morgan Murphy?
Yeah, CEO of Ackerley Advertising, moonlighting up there at Plaza Colonial. That was great. It was a beautiful event, and I said on my Facebook post that Jane Hamilton always does things with class, and that was a really classy event. Then I spent some time with you, Matt Neely. I went to the Tucson Advertising Education Foundation.
Indeed.
And American Advertising Federation Tucson Hall of Fame event last night, and some of our friends got some much-deserved awards. Our friend Steve Earnhardt got the silver medal, and Patty's daughter got an award, and Alan Michaels got an award. It was cool. It was kind of fun to be there.
It was a very nice event, and yeah. The advertising community gathered to recognize people that have helped further the cause.
Yeah,
and people that have dedicated their lives to bringing customers and entertainment and everybody making a community here on the airwaves that we enjoy so much. So thank you all for tuning in. You are all the other part of the equation. So we're all here together, and it was a nice way of celebrating that community and what they do.
It was great last night to see all of the people that have blossomed in their careers at in advertising. Deb Wagner, who's the general manager of Arizona Lotus Radio, and Steve, who's the president of iHeart, and lots of just friends that we've known over the years that were there, and recognizing wonderful people. So I don't know how the food was, though. We were at Paloma Country Club.
It was outstanding.
Was it really?
Yes, it was very good.
Yeah,
it was good.
I did my normal Ed Ackerley talk to 8,000 people routine, and by the time I got through doing that, it was over. Well, that's my style, though.
Well, I like it because, you know, I can promise that I will buy you a cocktail, and then I don't have to fulfill the promise because you're gone.
I've never.
So thanks for saving me $5 last night.
And then we went. I had to go and be at another event, which was the Arizona Sands Club had their pregame pep rally that they have on Thursdays. Actually, next week it's on Wednesday, but it was on Thursday, and a really nice visit from Coach Brent Brennan. Had a nice chat with him and talked with him for quite a while, and his chief of staff, Jeff, who was there, and Rick Croner, the general manager of Arizona Sands Club. And of course, the band came in and did their thing, and Chad Shoopman and Cliff were there. It was great. It was, man, talk about raising the roof in the Arizona Sands Club. When that band gets to play, and it is amazing, and it was fun. We had a really good time, and it was great to see Coach, and got a chance to give him my offensive perspective of what he needs to do this week and
well,
all that.
he's got probably 20,000 to 30,000 routine people with all sorts of advice for him.
Yeah,
and since we have a minute, I did see a video clip of his defensive coordinator, and I cannot remember for the life of me the last name. I want to say Danny Gonzalez. I've got his name wrong, I'm sure, but I got to see his some clips that Damian Alameda posted online of his defensive coordinator and his comments at the press conference. And this is a no excuses guy. You know, they held Hawaii to 2 field goals last week.
Right.
Yet he was there telling them why and how the defense kind of let him down and said, you guys traded what was potentially a good, solid defensive effort to a so-so. I mean,
right.
They didn't demean them. I mean, they won easily, and
yeah.
Hawaii never got it into the end zone. However, I liked his accountability style, and he was a very colorful speaker in a good way, not that he was cursing or anything. But I think that kind of dynamism kind of motivates young people, and he sounds like somebody that can motivate, instruct, Okay. Yeah. So, and bring the defense to what we in Tucson of our age, mm-hmm. right? Remember mm-hmm. As one of the standouts of the team as being stingy with yardage. So I thought that was kind of neat.
Danny Gonzalez, is that
Danny Gonzalez? That does ring a bell. I believe you got it right there.
Yeah.
So looking forward to hearing more from him, and looking forward to seeing low scores on the other on the opponent's scoreboard side of the scoreboard.
I got a verbal. Of course, we were in a setting where you say yes to lots of things and so forth. But I did get Coach Brennan to say yes to coming on the Morning Voice.
Good.
So he's going to be here. But you know, we were talking, I was talking to Chad Shoopman afterwards, and so I've heard this from so many people. Erica Barnes is another friend of mine who is a former athletic director there, and they all talk about what a great guy Brent Brennan is, and what a nice person, and how the kids respect him, and what a great guy he is. And hopefully this year he has the talent that he needs. Well, he had talent last year, but this is his year to try and see if he can pull it all together and do some damage on the record.
Just hoping to see some progress to a person. Everybody says that I don't know the coach, but everybody says he's a very good person. And on Daigie on the offensive side, I think we'll get some, well. Obviously, they put 40 points up last week, so they're doing something right.
Yeah.
And Hawaii was not NAU either, so, right? So,
yeah.
And Hawaii had beat Stanford, who's maybe not so.
But they're a pretty good Hawaii's a pretty good team, you know, even going back to the Dick Tomey days when he coached out there.
Sure.
They've always been I always liked it because when we played Hawaii there, it was an excuse to go to Hawaii, so
yeah, right.
Go see Dick in his Hawaiian shirt. That was pretty fun. Yeah, I was actually talking to Ricky Hunley too later, and we were just talking about the atmosphere. You know, he's been around, obviously, the program since he left as a player, and has been back as a coach a couple of times. And he also talks about a different atmosphere. Everybody loved Jed Fish's mind for the game. What a great, great tactician.
You bet.
He was like I got to go to one of his events, and they called it breakfast and ball or something like that, and you got to go in and you got to see him talk to the kids about what they were going to do at practice that morning. And oh my goodness gracious, I played football, but to me it was hieroglyphics. It was so complicated, and it was, you know, an NFL offense that he was looking at there, and it was kind of cool. Actually, I understood it. It was very complicated, and so he was a really good tactician. Jed is a good tactician, and Brent's a little bit different. Brent's more of a leader kind of. Not that he's hands off, but he's not as involved as Jed was. Jed was involved in every single play, every single second, every single, wanted to know everything, very control oriented. Mm. And Brent's much more of a leader, a management leader. And what a great conversation with him last night. He just seems to be like a really good guy. So rooting for him. Hopefully he does well. So they're playing Weber State from the big football powerhouse out of Ogden, Utah, huh?
That's right.
Yeah. How'd they pick up this game? That's my question.
Yeah, because I think they're FCS, right? Or right. What would have been the old Division 1, 2A or something
right,
like that.
Right. I wonder how they got him.
A big check.
Yeah, a big check.
It was like the year that we paid, not that I want to rehash the subject, but the year we paid Northern Arizona University $700,000 to beat us in Tucson, like that. Yeah, so that's how those games, not that I understand the whole business side of that, but that's how those games usually come about.
It's really the warm-up games for the season is what it is. It's their get everything together. It's kind of like, I won't say it's a practice game because obviously the wins and loss count towards the end of the season. But
I got to say, I was happy to see that they did well against Hawaii, which, again, they started off against a real team. And not that Weber State is not a real team, but, you know, better competition. And the other thing is, and I haven't looked ahead, but and nor should the team, but next week's game against Kansas State is a Friday game.
It is a Friday
game. So we're going to go straight from here, Ed, to the tailgate.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Is that,
okay.
We start at 9 o'clock at tailgate. Yeah.
Kegs and eggs.
Yeah.
So we're going to do that. But I believe this year may be like last year, where even though they're a conference rival, it may be I don't know. It may be considered a non-conference game, which it was last year.
I think it is considered a non-conference game.
Because it was on the books before the conference, before we joined the conference.
I believe they are calling that one a non-conference game. And it's interesting that it's on Friday and it's at 6 o'clock instead of 7 o'clock. So we won't get home at midnight on Friday night.
Oh, then. It is at 6? They've planned that far ahead. Hallelujah.
Yeah, I know.
It's usually hard. They announce like 2 days before. Yeah, it's going to be at 8 o'clock.
Every once in a while that when ESPN comes or somebody and they announce that it's 10 a.m., it's like, oh, man, I didn't have that in my bingo card. So,
I'll tell you. So the interesting thing about that is, as I recall, last year's game against Kansas State was on a Friday night as well, because I was at an event that Friday night. And they said, well, there's a TV on over in the bar. And I'm like, I probably can't sneak out. I would I would be fine with it. I didn't know how Mrs. Neely would have felt about that. So
you could have pulled a Ed Ackerley like I did last night, and say you had to go do something real important. And I did have to go out. I was getting Dave Slavin.
It was a long trip to the bathroom for Matt. I come in, counting your winnings from the bet you made.
Last night I went to get a certificate for White Stallion Ranch out of my car for Dave, and unfortunately it took me the rest of the night. I did give him the certificate, okay, but I never came back after that.
That was good of you.
Yeah.
He said, I'll be right back.
Yeah, exactly. Speaking about being right back, let's take a quick break. We'll be back with more on The Morning Voice and talk about all the good things going on in Tucson. This is the day we talk about business success, organization success, and wonder at the University of Arizona. You're listening to KVOI, and this is The Morning Voice. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. We were talking a little football, talking about being with Coach Brent Brennan last night from the University of Arizona. He was fun to talk to, and Jeff, his chief of staff. And then, when we left you last Friday, we were in the second half of the Walden Grove Sarita game.
How did it work out?
Well, Thursday night, it was
beautiful.
This
is a two-day football game, just to get everybody up to speed.
Yeah. There was literally 3,000 people in the stands. They say it was one of the biggest attended games in the history of Walden Grove and Sarita. And they brought in 10 extra sets of bleachers, and they were full to the brim, just totally full on Thursday night. And then the Lightning started coming in. So with 1 minute left in the first half, the second quarter, 1 minute left, they had everybody all the teams go to the gym and ask the people to leave the stands. Then they called it about a half hour later. So they all came back. When I say they all came back the next night, they came back on Friday at 7 o'clock and played that 1 minute in the second quarter, and then they had a 1 minute halftime, and then they played the third, fourth quarter. Oh, my goodness gracious. There was 3,000 people there on Thursday. There was probably 2,999 on Friday. They came back.
It was fantastic.
Amazing. And it was just – and Tom Murphy, who's the mayor, a good friend of ours, he was helping us, and Manny, who was the superintendent – was there, and they helped us give out the awards, and it was one of the biggest things that's happened in Sarita in the longest time. It was amazing, and so that's what The Morning Voice is about, successes like that, talking about the good things going on in our community, and to get that whole town of Sarita and getting both schools. They're only about 3 miles apart on Sarita Road there, so it's kind of neat to have them being excited about something cool, and the kids were great. All well behaved. There were no problems, and it was just wonderful. I had a good time. That was good.
It was very good. It kind of reminded me of the TV show Friday Night Lights, when you get this small town football and the whole town comes out, and it was great. And of course, it was a Coaches for Charity kickoff game, which added to the festivities. Yeah. We gave away a couple of awards to the signature coach, Chris Fanning, and who's going into the Pima County Sports Hall of Fame this year. So
we do it on Thursday night to try and get, the TV coverage of the three. And they were all there. They had some great stories. We had two nights of it because they had to come back again on Friday night. But you don't ever want that. The very first game that we had 15 years ago was a doubleheader at Tucson High School. It started at 5 o'clock. Two teams played, and then two teams started playing at 8 o'clock. Lightning delay. The poor kids didn't get home until about midnight because we had a half hour, 45-minute lightning delay that very first game. So having Thursday night games is tough for the administration when you're pulling kids and getting them not home until 10 o'clock or so, and they got to be at school the next morning. So, but it was fun. It was great. We had a great time. So,
Well, if you do want to go back, the podcast, you can listen to the audio podcast at kvoi.com. You can go to 1030 The Voice channel on YouTube and actually watch representatives of both teams, players and coaches, speak here, here on The Morning Voice a couple of weeks ago. It was a good episode, and definitely go back and watch it.
And it was really cool that the two coaches are friends, and they did a great job. Very professional. Walden Grove ended up winning 36-10, but they played well, and the kids that were here in the studio with them were, that quarterback from Walden Grove is a pretty good little quarterback. Mm. So I told him he needed to go become friendly with Coach Brennan and say, hey, need another guy from Tucson. I got one for you. So he was pretty good. And it was a good team. So it was good. We had a good time doing that. And then on my way here, I only got about 3 hours sleep last night. I am just exhausted. But I Ubered here this morning, and my Uber driver was recognizing me. And you know, we were talking about running for mayor and all that stuff. And she said something, Matt, which I know that Ted talks about and Grant from time to time.
Okay.
And the roads in this town. And she's an Uber driver.
Who would know better? Yeah. Somebody spends the day traversing them.
And we're talking about how, and I gave the, my up in Phoenix and in other places, they treated the dirt before they put the asphalt down. Here in the old Pueblo, we just scraped the dirt and put the asphalt over the top of it. And that's why many of our roads are in such terrible shape, is they've been on dirt for 70 years. And when you have a little bit of monsoon moisture get down through the cracks, and you have the heat during the summer and it's cracking the asphalt, and then the monsoons come and seep down in there and eat away the dirt underneath, and then a big 8,000-pound truck comes along and drills over the crop, it's going to turn into what we have, these washboards and these potholes. And so when you go up to Phoenix, many of their roads have concrete under them on some of the, well, all the freeways, obviously, but some of their thoroughfares have concrete, and they've treated the ground so it doesn't do that up there like it does here. So
it's interesting you mentioned this, that that it came up in conversation, because years and years ago, and I think his name was Galargis, who's Pima County transportation guy, and he came and spoke with a group I was affiliated with years ago. Mm-hmm. And he talked about why people were asking why, when you redo a mile stretch of road such as Sunrise or something, or River, why does it take so long? And this is the answer he gave. He says, well, when that was put down, it was just kind of graded flat, and then the road was put on it. And now when we go back to redo it, all the utilities have to be cut in, the underlayment, all that stuff that has to, all the buildup to do it.
It's about five layers if you do it right.
Yeah. Right. Asterisk if you do it right. And so he talked about that's why some of these road seemingly it's a road widening or replacing the pavement.
Right.
But seemingly why they take so long is because basically the first time they were put down, it was just...
Yeah. I don't want to be a complainer, because I'm not a complainer. I'm a problem solver. But I do have a little bit of a pet peeve, and it happened twice to me now. One is on Glen from Craycroft to, Swan or whatever, Country Club even.
You mean the road in Tucson?
Yeah, they repaved it. Beautiful repaving. Beautiful. It was beautiful on
They repaved...
Glen.
Yeah. Oh, Glen. Okay. Yeah. I thought you were talking about Fort Lowell, dirt road.
No, Glen. Yeah, it was beautiful. It was beautiful. Literally 1 week after they finished the road, the construction crew came and dug a trench right across it.
It happened on Broadway.
And it happened on Speedway.
Two-year project on Broadway, between Country Club and Tucson or wherever it was.
And they go right across it.
And they're cutting right into it. It's like, that's a seam that's going to leak in about, a year.
Yeah. My question is, I just can't believe it. I mean, that the road is being paved. Why don't you dig that trench before they put the stuff down? You'd think, but it just not part of, and they did it right by I live out on East Speedway, way out far East Speedway, and they repaved part of Speedway out east, very far out there. I'll be darned if they're not building a storage facility out there, and they cut across, not once, but twice, have cut these two big trenches across Speedway, and it's like they just paved this a month ago, and now we're cutting into it again. It just doesn't make any sense to
me. On the other side of the coin, and this was maybe within the last 3 months, I saw a story on one of the local news stations, and they were talking with folks in a neighborhood near Broadway and Kolb, I believe it was, and they said, look at these, they brought the camera person and the reporter out there, said, just look at this, we have to drive over this every day. And they went to the city and said, and they did the they did that. They said, look, we know we have to do all these other things first, and these things aren't ready, so we can't do the street until we do these things. So they're trying to do it the other way around. You just can't win.
And the other thing that we were talking about, too, this morning on the way in, that if, you know, the of course, it's aviation's a state project, but, you know, when you get a road going in Tucson, well, let's just use Grant as an example. You get that going, okay, it's going to take 2.5 years to get Grant finished.
Yeah.
If this was in Phoenix, they'd be working 24/7. There'd be lights on. They'd have it done in not 20 months, but in 20 days.
You are correct, sir.
And that's just what we live with is we're the stepchild down here in southern Arizona. We just can't seem to, you know, these overpasses over I-10 are taking 2-3 years to get done. It's like, come on, you go up to Phoenix, you 90 days out, you go up there, there's another overpass over the freeway. When we come back, we're going to talk to with Timothy Cromer. He's with Executive Director of Philanthropy at the Catholic Community Services of Southern Arizona. This is The Morning Voice. We'll get going and talk about success and a little bit of wonder coming up after the 8 o'clock hour. Again, you're listening to KVOI, 1030 AM, trusted local news and talk, and this is The Morning Voice. Good morning and welcome back to The Morning Voice. This is the Friday version where we talk about success for the first hour, and then we talk about wonder at the University of Arizona for hour number two at the 8 o'clock hour. I am your host, Dr. Ed Ackerley, and our guest for success this morning is Tim Cromer. He is the Executive Director of Philanthropy at Catholic Community Services of Southern Arizona. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Ed. Thanks so much for having me.
So you have a little bit of a background in this kind of work. Tell us a little bit about how you made your way to the Catholic Community Services Group.
I do, yeah. So I feel like I've been called to helping people in need pretty much my whole life. I went to seminary, and I was trained as a United Methodist minister.
That's great.
And I served churches in the Baltimore, Washington area for a long time before moving to Tucson around 12 years ago to be closer to family. And for the last 12 years, I've been working in Tucson nonprofits in a lot of different capacities, from creating partnerships with faith communities, to leading food banks, to leading a nonprofit that helps public schools. And during that time, I became well familiar with Catholic Community Services and the good work that they do. And so when the opportunity came up to join this great organization, I couldn't pass it by.
Right.
And this role really combines my passion for serving the most vulnerable in our community and being in a faith-based nonprofit and helping people give to causes that they're very passionate about.
Right, right. So you kind of hit on it, what I was going to ask you next, which is why service like this, and it's more of a vocation for you than it is perhaps maybe an avocation, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so
absolutely.
It's in your DNA to serve people, and so working with the Catholic Community Services, we'll talk about all the wonderful things that the organization does and has been doing over the years, for many years. For listeners who are unfamiliar with Catholic Community Services of Southern Arizona, can you give us a little overview of what the mission is and then the populations that you serve?
Sure. So Catholic Community Services of Southern Arizona has been serving the most in need for over 90 years. We've been around for a long time. Each year, we impact over 100,000 people throughout all of Southern Arizona. And our mission is rooted in Matthew 25:35-36. It's a scripture where Jesus tells his disciples, when you help the most vulnerable in your community, you were actually helping me. He said, when I was hungry, you gave me food. When I was thirsty, you gave me drink. A stranger and you welcomed me. Naked, gave me clothing. I was ill and you cared for me. I was in the prison and you visited me. And so our services and the populations we serve are directly reflected from that. So we provide food at our food banks, shelter for those who are unhoused, child care for children who would otherwise be left home alone, behavioral health care for those with mental health issues, medical respite for those leaving the hospital with nowhere to go, and the list just goes on and on. And despite all of these services, our actual mission statement is quite short. It's our mission is to help strengthen children, adults, families, and communities by providing help, creating hope, and serving all.
Right. And you, I was down at the center, Casalita, and that all has wrapped up, but the government called on Catholic Community Services to help with the influx, huge influx of immigrants that came across over the last 10 years or so.
That's
and
great.
And you still do some immigration services help in that area, but that's not what that center's been closed now. And so there's lots of other things that you do. But the point I was making there is that although you're a nonprofit and obviously affiliated a little bit with that whole concept of the Catholic Church, you're your own entity.
That's correct.
Separate and apart from the diocese, and you operate in a different kind of a realm, right?
That's correct. We're very closely connected to the diocese, and we're mm-hmm. very connected to all the different Catholic parishes in the community, but we are still our own separate nonprofit. We mm-hmm. we operate on our own bylaws and all that kind of right. That kind of stuff.
Your own governance, your own board of directors and
exactly.
all that. And,
exactly.
And your job is to help raise the money to fund these projects that the Catholic Community Services gets involved in, and that's a challenge in and of itself, right?
It's a great role, though. I love it.
Yeah, going around with a tin cup and saying, hey, will you give? So our guest today is Tim Cromer. He is the Executive Director of Philanthropy at Catholic Community Services of Southern Arizona. First off, that's a neat title, Executive Director of Philanthropy. When I was looking at that, I thought, well, that's kind of a neat title. Obviously, over 90 years, there's lots of people who just annually give, and gifts come in on a regular basis, and you get support that's kind of just institutional, if is a good word for it. But you got to continually prime the pump and get money coming in. What are some of the strategies that you use to make that happen?
Yeah, so some people might find it difficult or awkward to ask others for money to give to a cause or an organization. But I realized long ago that the people around us, the people in our community, are very generous mm-hmm. and they want to give. And they might not want to give to every cause or organization. But when they are passionate about something and when they hear about the wide variety of services that we offer, I find that people are happy to give. They mm-hmm. are, they want to be a part of making a difference in our community. And so I think that my passion to help people and my ability to connect people with things that they're passionate about and the programs that we offer can make a big difference in drawing people in and helping right. them to give.
When you talk about every year 100,000 people served in our community, well, the city of Tucson population is 550,000. If you incorporate all of the dioceses and Pima County is a big part of that, Cochise County, Santa Cruz County, you know, it's about 1.5 million in Southern Arizona. You're impacting 10% of that. You're impacting 20% if we're just talking about the city of Tucson population, but you're impacting 10% of Southern Arizona.
That's correct.
And one way or another is affected by the Catholic Community Services. And that's a pretty strong record. That's a lot of involvement with a lot of people.
It really is.
And you're providing that that kind of service to the community. So let's talk just a little bit about how people make donations to the Catholic Community Services. Obviously, it's a 501c3, so it's a nonprofit organization, and they can give you money directly or indirectly, all those kinds of things.
Sure, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, so the easiest way is to go to our website, ccs-soaz.org, right. And give online. You can give by check. You can give through bequests if you want to put us in mm-hmm. your estate planning. People give donations of their cars.
Right.
there's a lot of different ways. And Catholic Community Services is a Arizona charitable tax organization. So mm-hmm. dollar for dollar, you can get up to $983 off your taxes if you're a couple filing jointly, or $470 if you're somebody filing individually. And that goes directly off of your state taxes. So if you want to give...
That's a very attractive offer. Lots
really
of people
is.
Take advantage of that. I
Absolutely.
Bet. Yeah. So you direct where your money goes as opposed to it going into a general fund and the state deciding where it goes.
Exactly.
Right?
That's the beauty of it.
And one of the problems we face in Tucson per capita, there's more nonprofits in Southern Arizona than there is anywhere else in the country, they say. I don't know if that's an urban myth or if that's actually true, but you go to the Community Foundation, some of the other places, I'm sure it's pretty apparent that we have a lot of people asking for a lot of money. What is interesting, though, is that they're all successful and that Southern Arizona is a very giving community.
It really is. It's a very generous community, and I've seen that over the years.
Yeah, and that's good because we want them to continue to to give to you and to give to CCS as well as giving to others as well. So what are some of the challenges you face in fundraising then and in donor engagement when you're trying to get people to give that kind of money?
Yeah, so you hit the nail on the head in some ways in terms of so many nonprofits in Tucson. The statistic you pointed out is true. There are more nonprofits in Tucson per capita than any other major metropolitan area in the country. And so I think being able to cut through all of that noise and mm-hmm. to be able to really engage folks to tell our story in a way that really connects with them, that is a big challenge.
Right.
And so we're working on ways to tell our story in a more succinct way, in a way that can really connect and drive people to support us. As you saw, we have a lot of services.
Right.
And so that can be a blessing or a curse in some ways, where mm-hmm. There's so much to offer, but at the same time, there's something for everybody.
Right.
There's something for everybody to connect with.
It's easy to wrap your head around, say, a Casa de los Niños for little guys, or even the Southern Arizona Food Bank and so forth, some of these big organizations that have kind of a singular mission.
Mm-hmm.
But Catholic Community Services has this very broad mission of taking care of lots of different people.
Absolutely.
And so, but the beauty of that is if people can find their niche within that, and
for sure.
if it's mental health, or if it's a little bit of immigration, a little bit of homelessness, and you know, you can find your niche and direct your funds to that if you want to, right?
Absolutely. And I also feel like it helps for us to understand that the way that our services work is they're not just receiving one service. Oftentimes, they're receiving multitude of services for us. So it's a wraparound kind of organization. So not only are they receiving food from their food banks, they could be receiving counseling from our behavioral health therapists during the same visit even.
Right, right. And some support for kids and families and all sorts of things that are, wraparound services. We'll come back. We'll talk a little bit more about Catholic Community Services, and we'll also maybe invite one of your buddies in to talk with us a little bit about the Cornerstone Gala coming up. This is KVOI 1030 AM, and you're listening to The Morning Voice. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. We're talking this morning with Tim Cromer, who is the Executive Director of Philanthropy for Catholic Community Services of Southern Arizona. Good morning again, Tim.
Thanks, Dan.
And we'll also welcome Donald Drain, who is the chairperson of the upcoming Cornerstone Gala. So two different organizations under the same roof, helping one another. So The Cornerstone Gala is a function of the Catholic Foundation of the Diocese of Tucson, and the Catholic Community Services is a separate organization that provides services throughout Southern Arizona, but they support each other, and the some of the proceeds from the foundation gala will probably go to CCS. So
they're
one of the big donors to CCS over the years, right?
Yeah, the Catholic Foundation has been a very large supporter of Catholic Community Services
right.
over the years, and we thank them for all the gifts they give.
Yeah. So Donald, you are the you missed a meeting. And they made you chairman of the Cornerstone Gala, right? And
something like that.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about the gala and it's coming up and what's all going to be happening. You're going to honor a couple of wonderful people and it's a great event. So tell us a little bit about the gala.
It's the 43rd annual Cornerstone Gala, and we're honoring two people. And this is a very special one. These two ladies, two sisters.
Wonderful.
Between them, they have given 131 years of service to the Lord and to the mission.
Right.
So I personally and all of the committee are just really into this one because we're honoring people who are still working in their and they're in their 80s.
Yeah, and doing a great job at that. I mean,
doing unbelievably grand
Sister
job.
Lois is amazing, and it's amazing what she does. And so it's great that they're going to be honored. And so where and when is the event?
It's on a week today. That's September 12th at Westin La Paloma Resort, 5:30 arrival, silent auction, cocktails, and then the event starts at 7 p.m. in the ballroom.
Well, they're redoing the ballroom at the Westin La Paloma, and you're going to be one of the first events in there, and one side of it is going to be beautiful, and it's nice of them to redo the ballrooms right before you show up. So
yes,
that's great.
The ballroom will be finished on Thursday at 8 a.m., and we start going in at 10 a.m.
That's amazing, isn't it? It's just going to
be honestly.
A magic pixie dust to make something. We're talking about Catholic stuff. It's a miracle. It's a miracle. It's absolutely a miracle. So you do lots of different things with the foundation, but mostly it's an organization that raises money for the services that the Diocese of Tucson is able to provide, but then also helps other organizations like CCS. So tell us a little bit about the foundation itself and the purpose of it.
Yes, we raise money for different entities that they say are necessary, but the Cornerstone Gale itself, the main reason there is to help with emergency funding of needs.
Right.
Because during the year, we don't know what's going to happen to some of the parishes, and we have 77 mm-hmm. parishes spread over all of southern Arizona. And
right.
we are the fifth largest landmass diocese in the USA.
Mm-hmm.
So we, in the last year, we have fixed roofs down in Benson,
mm-hmm.
Helped with emergency funding on air conditioning, security cameras. So we really don't know what the need will be for the next year, but we're raising more and more money because the needs are getting more and more elevated every year.
And this is interesting. It kind of dovetails into what CCS does, which is to provide ongoing support for families and mental health and in all sorts of different things. And these are ongoing needs that happen on a regular basis. The gala comes in and is that emergency funding for things that kind of you just can't predict.
Right.
Yeah. So it's a nice dovetail between the two. There's not many seats left at the Cornerstone Gala. It's kind of like sold out, right?
We're almost there, but we'll gladly. I know the ballroom, having worked at that hotel for almost 30 years.
Yes, that's where I know you from, yeah.
We can get one more table in the corner, but on a serious note, we're up to 83 tables, so 830 people
right.
coming, and that's a compliment to this community. To get 830 right after Labor Day weekend to a gala is usually very challenging in my career.
Yeah. I always go and make the horrible mistake of raising my hand at the wrong time and getting a $5,000 vacation to San Diego or something. You know, I try to help and last man standing. Elizabeth, we got a really nice trip to San Diego last time and it was wonderful.
Oh,
we had a great time and it was kind of fun. It was kind of fun to do it, but so I don't know what they have on store this year, but we'll go make we'll go and see. Yeah,
this year we're doing a bit more of the real focus is raising funds. So we're having a paddle race, which we haven't really done.
All right.
Usually we would have an envelope in the middle of the table for the
right.
different guests, but that gets lost under the coffee stained evening as the night wears on. But this year we're bringing in a professional auctioneer, and because we are the committee, we're all convinced that we need to raise money, and a paddle race will really help and improve the efforts.
That's great. That's great. So, Tim, talking about CCS and the services you provide, how can people support you? Of course, they can go to the website and make a donation, but can they volunteer? Can they help in other ways?
Absolutely. Yeah, we have a number of volunteer opportunities, whether that's helping out at the food bank, to helping folks prepare taxes for low-income
right.
seniors.
You don't have to be Catholic to do this,
that's
right?
correct. You yeah. don't have to be Catholic.
You can be Methodist like you.
Yeah, I'm not Catholic myself.
Yeah, right.
But there's so many ways to connect to the mission, no right. matter what your faith or lack thereof. And so you can give clothing to our clothing banks. We're looking for new socks and underwear at our medical respite center.
Right.
You can also give CCS-SOAD.org.
Right.
SOAZ.org, sorry.
Yeah. You can also donate things like gift cards to grocery stores and stuff because the food bank can use those.
Absolutely.
If you've been gifted some things, you can always turn them in to either the foundation or to you, and they can be turned, like you said, even automobiles have been turned into cash.
Yeah. During the holiday season, our Pio Decimo Center raises toys for the children
right.
That go there.
So there's a lot of different ways that you can get involved, and that's great. Well, we want to thank you both for your service to the community, 1.5 million strong in southern Arizona. The gala coming up next week, and we hope to be there and be excited. And thank you for all you do for Catholic Community Services of Southern Arizona and what you do for the Cornerstone Gala.
Thank you.
This is The Morning Voice on KVOI, and I feel very blessed this morning with all these Catholic guys in here. I'm going to make the sign of the cross right now and say, God bless you all. And so we'll be back in just a minute with Wonder on great things happening at the University of Arizona on The Morning Voice. Welcome to The Morning Voice, and I am your host, Dr. Ed Ackerley, and on Fridays we talk about the good things happening at the University of Arizona. and we call this wonder. I often say that people drive down Speedway, look over at those red brick buildings and wonder what the heck is going on over there. So wonder celebrates that wonder and tells people about the wonderful things happening at the University of Arizona. It's been a blessing for me. I just started my semester teaching about 500 students again, so I got another year of grading papers on weekends, so it's been kind of nice.
Were you there when the school colors were silver and sage? Yeah, have you been that long?
There was one room. It was in Old Main, and it was a big giant schoolhouse, and we all were in the same room together. So it's
called
been,
Old Ed.
Yeah, so, yeah. I'm gonna get one of those. I got one of my gifts they gave me for being there for a long time was a cup or something like that. The box that it came in was more beautiful than the thing that was inside of it. So I don't know if I get anything for being there for 35 years, but we'll see. So
a big thank you from
yeah,
all of us.
A big thank you, yeah. Wonder is sponsored by Caruso's Italian Restaurant on historic 4th Avenue and our good friends at Hughes Federal Credit Union. We have a couple of guests with us today. We have Ewan McLeod. He's Associate Professor of Optical Sciences. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
We also have, we're kind of doing a twofer here. We also have Dr. Buell Januzzi, who is the director of the Stewart Observatory and department head in astronomy, professor of astronomy, and they're in charge also of the Richard F. Karras Mirror Lab. So good morning to you.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
So we got a little theme going on here. That theme is optics and what the university does. World famous for optics around the world, talking about optics. So let's talk first, Ewan, about you and your job in the optics optical science department. Tell us a little bit about how you kind of got drawn into the field and what's exciting to you about optics, working in the optics side.
Yeah, thank you, Ed, for having me here. So I started as a mechanical engineer in undergraduate, and then I really enjoyed kind of schoolwork and learning things and doing research as well. So then I wanted to get a PhD, and so I got a PhD in a mechanical and aerospace engineering department, but ended up doing a lot of laser materials processing. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of how I transitioned from mechanical engineering into optics. And so from then on, I did a postdoc at UCLA in biophotonics. So I kind of got in the biological applications of optics, essentially what that is. And then after that, I was essentially in optics forever.
Right.
I love it, yeah.
Well, did you meet your wife at UCLA or here? Where did you guys
meet?
Yeah,
I met my wife back in California.
Yeah, because she's also at the University of Arizona, and she was a guest here a couple of weeks ago. She, as I was laughing with you earlier, she volunteered you that you were going to be on the show with me today. So.
Yes.
She did great, by the way. She was fantastic. She's a good person. And you know that. Now, you wouldn't have married her. I know that, so... So you have a lab. It's called the Soft Nanophotonic Systems Lab. And tell us a little bit about what is nanophotonics and soft materials and all that stuff that you deal with.
Yeah, so nanophotonics is studying how light interacts with things that are about the same size as the wavelength of the light. So the light that we see, kind of red to blue, those wavelengths are, say, 700 to 400 nanometers. And that's kind of smaller than a bacteria, bigger than a virus. It's that sort of size range. Mm-hmm. And so we're interested in how does light interact with those objects. And what makes that interesting is a lot of the physics that applies to larger length scales doesn't really apply to these very small length scales. So it kind of changes the way the problem appears and the way to solve it. And there's a lot of interesting effects.
And how is the light at those wavelengths and that size and so forth, how does it differ from, say, something else? I mean, you're looking at this subatomic level, kind of. What makes it unique and different? How are you discovering how it's behaving?
So, at large length scales, basically, light you can think of as traveling in a straight line.
Right.
So, if you have light that leaves a flashlight, it just leaves the flashlight and goes straight where you want.
Like they say about the sun, that it takes 8 minutes to go from the sun to back
yep.
of my hand.
So, it does that in a straight line.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, so at these small length scales, light doesn't travel in a straight line. It starts to act more like waves, kind of going around a rock in a pond or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then at these even smaller length scales, it kind of almost loses the wave nature, and a lot of things are kind of coupled together,
mm-hmm.
Which makes things kind of interesting.
And from a physics standpoint, why does that happen? Why is it not traveling in a straight line? Why is it traveling in a wave? Do we know the reason why that's happening?
Yeah, I guess it all boils down to something called Maxwell's equations, which okay. are the kind of the fundamental equations that describe how light and electromagnetism in general works. So it's maybe a... It's a complicated answer.
It's kind of the confluence of those, yeah. And so it's it might have started out as a straight line, but when it gets down to that size, it's going to be into that waveform. And so, what are optical tweezers that you use in this process?
Yeah, so we use optical tweezers. Optical tweezers you can think of as a very small analog of essentially a tractor beam. So if you've watched, you know, Star Trek or something, and you see like a ship has a tractor beam that pulls something else, that's kind of like optical tweezers. The difference is optical tweezers don't work at that big length scale, but essentially what we do is we take a laser beam and we focus it down to a very small point, and that laser beam can apply forces on small objects and pick them up and move them around. So we're using this essentially as a 3D printer. So we want to build very small structures out of different types of materials, and we grab little nanoparticles with our laser and then put them in places to build some device or material or something.
That's amazing. So we're talking about one universe of the subatomic and the little, and then astronomy is about the big, the huge universe. But when you look up at the stars, they look like little pinpoints, but it's actually immense and huge and giant. And so as an astronomer, Dr. Buell, tell us a little bit about the Steward Observatory and the Mirror Lab and how you're doing, ironically, something similar, but only on a huge scale.
Yeah, it is similar. We're trying to make sure that our mirrors are precise at the scales that Ewan is trying to have his measurements be precise. But we're trying to collect as much light as we possibly can, because the more light we collect from an object, the more information we're getting.
Right, right.
And if you want to study a planet around another star, or you want to try to study the first stars forming in the universe, you need a lot of information. Excuse me. Mm-hmm. And giant mirrors enable you to gain more information.
You're collecting that information from that distant star and collecting it in these mirrors, and that's how you get the concentration of the energy to be able to look at it.
Yeah, there. Excuse me. There are two things that giant mirrors enable you to do. Well, it's one thing. You get to build a giant telescope, but what a giant telescope can do uniquely well is resolve fine detail. Mm-hmm. If you look at a planet with your eye, it just looks like a little dot. Jupiter is just a dot.
Right.
If you take a small telescope like Galileo did more than 400 years ago and look at Jupiter, Jupiter becomes a disk because it's a sphere. You can see details in its atmosphere. That's just going up in spatial resolution. Galileo was using a small telescope. If you take a telescope like the Large Binocular Telescope that's on Mount Graham, that has two of our 8.4-meter, 28-foot diameter mirrors on a common mount, we can resolve volcanoes on the moon of Jupiter. So what's changed in the last 400 years is just the technology enabling us to go beyond what our human eye can see to what a giant telescope can see.
So they're concentrating this energy from the universe into these giant mirrors and then pulling them into resolution so that it's meaningful. How are you looking at the nano light, the waves of this light that are small, as you said, smaller than a bacteria, bigger than a virus? How are you collecting that information? What are you looking at it with lasers, or how are you seeing that?
So we use a lot of microscopes in a couple different formats. There are kind of some conventional microscopes that just have engineered lenses,
like we would have in high school, and you look at something and it's just more sophisticated, but to the layman, a microscope is a microscope.
Yep.
But there's other kinds of microscopes too, or other kind of devices, right?
Yeah. So another kind of very different type of microscope that we're also using that is one that we're kind of trying to build ourselves. And those are something that we call a lens-free microscope. All we have is we have a light source, and then you have your microscope slide, and then we just have an image sensor. And so the image sensor you can think of as the camera part of your cell phone, but without any lenses. And so that just records the light that's hitting it. So what you record is you kind of record like a shadow or a silhouette of what's coming through your microscope slide. Mm-hmm. But we could computationally reconstruct what the object was that created that pattern.
Right.
And the advantage of this approach is the hardware is incredibly inexpensive and small and compact. And also we get to see a huge field of view, so a much larger area than you would see with a normal normal microscope.
So is AI helping you in this resolution of what might have taken a little while to get into that resolution? Is it speeding up that process of being able to determine what you're actually looking at?
Yep. Yeah. We use AI in a few different areas to do that sort of reconstruction. So yes, AI is
because you're both of you are dealing with data. You're dealing with energy and data, and it's coming at you, and you have to interpret that data into something that's understandable. And for guys like me that don't know anything about science, you know, you have to kind of dumb it down for people like me. But then for the other scientists that you're dealing with and so forth, and to make the 3D printer things, this all becomes comes into focus when you get these instruments, and they're helping you visualize what you're seeing, and the AI can help speed up that process a little bit, right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I think what you said about AI helping to speed things up is very apt, because a lot of times to train the AI, you have to use results that you get in another way.
Right.
So you have to use you have to figure out what the ground truth is, a lot of times people say, what the kind of gold standard or ground truth is. And then you use a whole bunch of these results to train the AI. And then once it's been trained on maybe 10,000 examples of things that you know are true, then it can start to generalize to new things. And
this is kind of the way astronomy works too. You discover things and that becomes the new benchmark. And then you discover more things and that becomes the benchmark. And you build on knowledge over, since Galileo in 400 years, has been a lot of building on of astronomy over those years, right?
Yeah, like Ewan was saying, I think you're building on the past results, but you always have to keep in mind that you might need to reinterpret what you're seeing in a new way. I mean, that's one of the wonderful things about science is you're open to being wrong.
Right.
You're open to recognizing we thought we understood this and now we don't, and then you improve your understanding.
I'm going to throw you a zinger. I ask all the astronomers that come in here this question. You know, we used to think, people years ago used to think the Earth was flat, you know, and if you don't get
some
too,
still do.
Yeah, don't get too close to the edge because you might fall off, you know. Yeah. I mean, what's on the other side of the edge? I always ask the question, what's on the other side of that 14.6 billion years ago? Is there an edge to that? Because we can't see that far. Is there a 14.9 billion years out there? We just can't see it because the light hasn't gotten here yet. And so.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. And there's some scientists that have models for how the universe evolves and works and how there might be multiple universes that would say, okay, I can tell you where I can see this imprint on our current universe. And then there are others that are saying, no, we're never going to know that. And you're asking a philosophical question.
Right, right.
Why question.
Yeah.
We're good at answering how questions.
Yeah. But even so, how come we're here at this time at this place is also a tough question to answer too. So how did we get here is another question.
So I can give you an answer. You might not like
it.
But if we weren't here, we couldn't ask ourselves that question.
There you go. So that is a philosophical. Yeah. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back and talk some more about optics, world famous optics at the University of Arizona, which we call Wonder. You're listening to The Morning Voice on KVOI. Welcome back to Wonder on The Morning Voice. You know, I like to be seen, Matt. That's why I have guys from the optics world in here today, because, you know, I just like to be seen.
There you go.
We have two wonderful...
We're seen and heard today because we're on the radio. We're on the AM radio, AM 1030, and then we're also on 1030 The Voice on YouTube, so people
That's
can watch
great.
Along.
They can watch along and see what we're doing, see what we look like. Everybody says I have a face for radio, so... Our two guests this morning are Dr. Ewan McLeod. He's Associate Professor of Optical Sciences at the university, so welcome back.
Thank you.
And Dr. Buell Januzzi, I should say. I shouldn't say Januzzi. I should say just Dr. Buell Januzzi, who is director of the Stewart Observatory and the department head in astronomy. And I want to talk a little bit, Dr. Buell, a little bit about the Mirror Lab and what a, you know, both of the things that you guys work in are world famous. And we have one of the highest end optical stuff at the University of Arizona. So when people drive down Speedway and see those buildings over there, one of the things that's happening is the optics industry is being fed by great research from both of your departments. Tell us a little bit about the Mirror Lab itself and how it came about and where it's located and what it does.
Happy to. Roger Angel is the original architect of the Mirror Lab, and he's still active. He's still on the faculty. He's in his 80s. But back in the late 70s, we were commissioning a new telescope, the Multiple Mirror Telescope on Mount Hopkins. Mm-hmm. It was made out of six mirrors that had originally been intended for the manned space lab, which was going to be an Air Force space station orbiting the Earth with gigantic binoculars looking down at the Soviet Union. That never flew, but the binoculars were made, and Aidan Meinel, who helped found what became the College of Optical Sciences, was director of Stewart Observatory as well. He knew about these mirrors that had originally been intended for space. And he got them donated to the university, and in partnership with the Smithsonian, we built the MMT. And when that telescope came online in 1979, it made sharper images than the other ground-based telescopes of the day. And the astronomers, Nick Wolf and others, quickly realized that this was because the glass in the mirror was coming to the same temperature as the ambient air at night. If you don't have the same temperature, you can think of the mirror as being like a hot plate, heating the air right above its surface, all making right. it turbulent. And when the light waves move through that air, the image gets blurry. So the fact that the mirror was not degrading its own image quality meant our images with the MMT were suddenly much better than similar-sized telescopes around the world. And Roger recognized, well, that's because this mirror had been light-weighted to go into space, because the biggest cost of any space telescope is getting that telescope off the Earth and into space. So we weren't heavily lightweighting ground-based mirrors at the time because we didn't think we needed to. Mm-hmm. But now that Roger recognized there's this advantage, you can have this lightweighted mirror that'll come to thermal equilibrium the same temperature more quickly and make great images. How big can we make those mirrors? And that's what got him started, experimenting in his backyard, then moving to a temple, a former synagogue. And then we moved to the mirror lab's current location in 1985 because we needed more room. We were partnering with the College of Optical Sciences. For their students, figuring out how to measure our mirrors is their research. For us, it's using the mirrors. Mm-hmm. And we needed room. And this was on campus. It was a parking lot. John Schaefer, transformational president of the university, worked with Peter Stripmatter, my predecessor, and Roger to get the space for the mirror lab under the football stadium. And it's a very slow process to make one of our giant mirrors. It takes 4 years, roughly, to make one of them. So even though they've been in operation there for 40 years, we've still only made 23 mirrors.
Right, because it takes so long. It
takes a long time.
And so people walk by the mirror lab all the time. They probably just don't know it's there, perhaps. It's on the east side of the stadium, in the parking lot, right below the stadium. It's under the stadium, basically. And it's right there by gate 4 is the main entrance of
That's right.
the lab. So so if you go into the game tomorrow, and you should go to the game tomorrow and support the Cats, take a glance over and say, there's that mirror lab. People can go see inside the mirror lab too, right?
They're public tours during the week, yeah.
Yeah, and so a docent would take you in there and kind of explain to you what's happening, and you kind of get a feel for what's
That's
happening
right.
there.
That's right.
Do you guys have tours at Optical Sciences? Do people get to come in into your beautiful building and look around and see what's going on there?
I mean, during business hours, it's open. One interesting thing is there's a very large collection of what I would say is antique optical
right.
instruments. And so if you go through the floors...
That's on the bottom floor? Or is
it's
it...
on. There's some on every floor, oh, but okay. you can start on the bottom floor. And there used to be, I think there still is anyway, the little pamphlets that kind of allow right. you to do a self-guided tour.
Right.
And you can see, you know, cameras from 100 years ago and this sort of stuff.
Yeah. And so what is the genesis of Optical Sciences over the last, you know, since the Optical Sciences Department kind of helped out in the 80s with, was that when the Optical Sciences Department was formed?
Well, they're older than that. They started when Meinel came in the 60s.
60s. So how did it get so world-renowned in its recognition as being one of the great optical sciences places and mirror labs and all those things? How did that all come about? Just because of results?
So I'll gush over them so okay. he doesn't have to. They get talented people. That's the key. You get the world's best people. There are only two places like the two colleges of optical science in the world right now. One is in Rochester, New York, and the other one is here. Ours got started as an optical science center led by Meinel, working for the Air Force and others on things like reconnaissance satellites, and but now they do everything that I think of as applied physics and information theory. And it's just incredible the impact that the College of Optical Sciences has on the local economy, on the industry around here.
There's so much technology transfer too into the commercial space of companies who have taken ideas back and forth, taking it from the university and commercializing it and making it into a commercial venture. But the flip of that, too, of commercial bringing it back to the university for research.
And the College of Optical Sciences and Roger Angel and the Mirror Lab, they're not afraid to try to do things that haven't been done before. In fact, they want to do things that haven't been done before. And they work together in teams that do things that haven't been done before.
When did the technology come in, or when did the realization happen that if we have one mirror, we collect this much light, but if we have multiple mirrors, we collect this much more light? I mean, it seems obvious to someone when you think about it, well, why didn't you just do that from the beginning? But they didn't do that from the beginning. It was one mirror.
Well, I mean, it is easier if you can make one mirror. That's easier.
Right.
But to make one mirror that's 10 meters in size, 20, 30 feet.
Pretty hard.
Diamond,
yeah.
is hard. So what makes the mirrors at the Mirror Lab unique is how big they are in mm-hmm. one piece. Mm-hmm. We make 8.4 meter diameter mirrors.
That's pretty big,
roughly,
isn't it?
Roughly 28 feet in diameter. The Giant Magellan Telescope, the telescope we're working on right now, we'll use seven of these mirrors to have a primary mirror the size of the first optic that's collecting light that is 25 meters in diameter.
Wow. Where will that be based, the Magellan Telescope?
So we're building it in the U.S. and reassembling it in Chile.
In Chile.
The mirrors are being made here. The telescope mount is being made in Rockford, Illinois. And then it's all going to be assembled in Las Campanas, Chile.
Is that the southern tip, or is that kind of in the middle of Chile?
It's closer to the middle, or yeah. the northern half.
High in the Andes Mountains.
High in the Andes so Mountains. And the reason we're going to Chile is because there's another telescope that we helped build called the Vera Rubin Observatory mm-hmm. that uses one of our 8.4 meter mirrors with a unique wide field. Ewan was talking about how he needs to have a wide field of view for his measurements. There are science cases in astronomy where you want to be able to see the whole sky as quickly as you can. And the Vera Rubin Observatory has a mirror that we made at the Mirror Lab that's unique in how big a field of view it can mm-hmm. image in one time. If you think of the full moon, in one snapshot, the Rubin Observatory can image a fraction of the sky that's as big as 49 full moons.
Wow.
So that means every three nights you can do the whole sky over and over and over again and make a movie over the next 10 years of everything that's changing brightness or moving. Cool. And we want the Giant Magellan Telescope to be able to follow up on all the discoveries that that telescope is making.
Very cool. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back and talk a little bit more about optics at the University of Arizona. You're listening to Wonder on KVOI 1030 AM, The Morning Voice. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. We're talking about wonder. We're talking about things you can see, the little things and the big things in the world. We're talking about optical sciences, and we're talking about astronomy and observing out into the universe. And our guests this morning are Dr. Ewan McLeod. He's an associate professor of optical sciences at the U of A. Good morning again.
Good morning.
And Dr. Buell Januzzi. He is the director of the Stewart Observatory, and he's the department head in astronomy and also head of the Richard F. Karas Mirror Lab. We were talking during the break about my experience of being able to go over to the Vatican Observatory and in Castel Gandolfo in 1979, and what a great experience that was for me. And that seems like eons ago, but that's a nanosecond in astronomy time, right? That's no nothing. That's a blink,
yeah, it is.
Blink of a whisper of an eye. But to me, it seems like a long time ago. But the Vatican's been involved at the U of A for a long time. Dr. George Coyne was one of the founders.
And that's right. He was director of the Vatican Observatory when they decided to move to Arizona right. for the same reason all the astronomers are in Arizona. We have great weather. We have communities that support keeping the skies dark mm-hmm. and educated workforce to run our telescopes.
And we can be, we do have monsoons during the summer and stuff, but it's pretty clear skies about 320 days out of the year, right?
We have wonderful weather here for astronomy.
Yeah, and it's clean. There's not a lot of dust and stuff, so you can actually see out into the world. Let's talk a little bit, Dr. McLeod, about the nano, looking at microscopes and looking at the small universes that you look at. Let's talk a little bit about how you, and so I say to a lot of people that optical sciences is one of the gifts that the University of Arizona gives to our community, and how important it is to the, as you were saying, you know, several thousand jobs and lots of companies have been born here. Talk a little bit about how optical sciences and the private companies work together and share technology and commercialize this research that you guys are coming up with. How do you turn that into something yeah. meaningful?
Yeah, so as Buell mentioned earlier, what we're trying to do is we're trying to do things that people have never done before. That's kind of what all scientific researchers in academia are trying to do. If it's something that's been done before, we look for a new problem that hasn't been done before.
Right.
Sometimes these things that have been done before, they're trying to reveal a truth about the universe. But in other cases, we're trying to, you know, build a new device or build a new material. And so a lot of times when we're doing that, we're kind of building something that is going to have say direct use by people outside of academia, by people who are, you know, in society, who are companies, who are building things. And in that case, the first step usually is to try to write an invention disclosure. Say we've invented something, and typically it can be some small component that is really the key enabling. You can think of this as the tiny little keystone that holds everything together, and that's the new piece that you've invented. And then from there, you can within about a year, you can head toward a provisional patent and then a full patent and so on. And so that's really kind of a lot of the steps that we mostly do in academia. And then there's an office at the University of Arizona called Tech Launch Arizona, mm-hmm. and they work on kind of handling some of this commercialization and patent processing, and also reaching out to companies to try to pull in these patents. I know from a lot of the different faculty members at the College of Optical Sciences, they have a lot of connections to local companies. They even call it Optics Valley. Mm-hmm. So there's this association of optics companies that are based in Tucson in southern Arizona, and they kind of call this association Optics Valley. And so there's a lot of companies that kind of research lots of different things and apply technology that's developed at the university, and then the university will take some of that technology that's been further developed and then use it in their own research. And there's a
what kind of companies network. Would be using your technology? Are we talking medical? Are we talking defense? Are we talking what types of industries would be
right? There's a couple industries. I mean, one is medical. So some of the stuff we've published recently is developing these microscopes that can do disease diagnostics. So if you think a few years back to kind of the COVID pandemic, initially at the start of the COVID pandemic, you had these PCR tests where you'd get a swab mm-hmm. and you'd drop it maybe at the pharmacy and you'd wait a couple days to hear the test. And then more recently, we've gotten these rapid diagnostic tests where you do it at home and you get the result within 15 minutes. We developed an approach that gives the kind of precision and accuracy of those really long tests, but in the time only about 15 minutes to an hour for the short test. So we're kind of interested in trying to improve diagnostics, not just for COVID, but other sorts of diseases too.
And so your nanotechnology that you're working on is then accelerating the ability for, in this case, medical to advance their technology a little bit based on the academic research that you've done in your program. Yeah, so that's kind of interesting. It's kind of the way it works in astronomy as well too. You are challenged by somebody to come up with something unique. For instance, the thing that's going across the sky now, that's is it a bird? Is it a plane? Is it an asteroid? Is it a comet? Is it a rogue planet? Is it a black hole? What is that thing that's going across? Your team, your astronomers at your place get to kind of look at that. And then, as you said, lots of jobs have been made around Arizona, southern Arizona, because of the astronomy component at the U of A.
So the jobs in southern Arizona come about from doing the astronomy, but also from enabling the astronomy. So right. when we build the Large Binocular Telescope, for example, it was M3 Engineering, mm-hmm. a Tucson-based company that was founded by U of A graduates that mostly works in the mining industry.
Right.
But they designed and helped manage the construction of the enclosure that holds the telescope up on Mount Graham.
Right.
So there, it's both the direct jobs, NASA mm-hmm. or the Department of Energy or DOD funding research.
It's a good
but also the related.
It's a really good example in both cases of melding academic research with commercial enterprise and having those come together and make it meaningful for and usable and sustainable, if you will, because, who knows with the funding that's coming out of Washington, D.C., how permanent that will be or how sporadic that might be over the coming years. It's nice to have some partners in the commercial space that maybe
absolutely
will take that risk and be engaged in trying to learn, in both cases, what they can do. What's on the horizon for optics for you? What are you looking at now? 20 years ago, you did some tag stuff. What are you doing now that you're kind of working on that you think is exciting?
So there are a few areas. One area is we're working on trying to kind of use this optical tweezer that I was talking about right. earlier to 3D print optical materials with kind of nanoscale structuring. And so the idea is if you take real everyday materials, things like your glasses and metals and stuff, but you're able to pattern them at really small length scales, at length scales that are about the same as the wavelength of the light, then you can build these materials that have really kind of weird exotic optical properties, things like a negative refractive index. So that kind of is a material that's going to bend light backwards. So a refractive index, normally if you look through, say, a straw in a glass of water, the straw mm-hmm. appears bent when it goes into the water. Mm-hmm. That's the refractive index of the water. And so if you have a material with something that could kind of bend that backwards, there are a lot of interesting devices that you can start to build with this. You can start to build better lenses that give you better resolution but are much smaller than a big lens. You can start to kind of build improved ways of handling data. So a lot of the applications in photonics are trying to take things that you're kind of sending data over optical fibers, but now can you send that data over really small length scales and kind of build a computer chip that uses light to send data rather than electrons to send data? And that's important for energy efficiency. So that's one of the main reasons why people are moving towards light for computing rather than electrons, is that you don't use as much power, which is better for the environment.
Which we just got through a big political thing in Tucson with Project Blue and using all the power and water to because of that very issue of using electrons, right? And so light would be less costly to do that over in scale.
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting. If you look over the last 50 years, optical fibers have been in use for a long time, and they've been very efficient for sending data, for example, across the country or from one continent to another. But that trade-off of when does it become more energy efficient to use light versus electrons has kind of gotten shorter and shorter distances as technology has improved. So now within these data centers, people are starting to use light to kind of send data from one server to another. It's not energy efficient enough yet to send light within a computer chip. Electrons are still a bit better than that, but we're kind of moving in that direction.
So this is a perfect example of your research being revolutionary, if you will, over time, of moving away from one accepted system of using something and then moving to something meaningful because of the technology has advanced based on the research that's being done at the University of Arizona. Same thing in astronomy, too. The same thing is true. We were talking about the Earth is flat, and is there an edge to the Earth versus, you know, what we see now, which is an amazing thing. So the U of A has contributed to this volume of knowledge about where we are and what's our place in the universe.
Yeah, I'm proud of the role the U of A has played in understanding our universe and then also sharing what we learn with the whole world.
Right.
We have wonderful education and outreach programs. If all you do is make the discovery and don't share it,
right,
then you're not living up to the mission.
Yeah, you're putting your light under the bushel barrel, as they say, and no one gets to see anything about it. Well, this is fascinating discussion. We'll come back with one more quick segment and talk about, before we do that, I want to give you each a gift certificate from our friends at Caruso's restaurant. Their founder, the most recent, he passed away just a year or two ago. He was a professor at the University of Arizona for 45 years, and he and his family have owned it. Now Andy is in charge over there, and she's a good, they have a great link with the University of Arizona. They've been open for 93 years, and they're down on 4th Avenue there, and they'd like to have you come down and enjoy some of their delicious food. We also are sponsored by our good friends at Hughes Federal Credit Union. We'll come back after the break and wrap up with optics at the University of Arizona, and we'll talk a little bit more about being seen, Matt Neely. We're going to be seen and become really well known because we're going to be seen really well.
You're on.
This is The Morning Voice. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. This is our last segment this morning of Wonder, where we talk about the great things going on at the University of Arizona. I just have to say optics and astronomy are two of my favorite things at the U of A, besides football and the Eller College and all the students and the great food and all the million other things. But I just love astronomy and optics. It's just it's kind of a little hobby of mine. Our guests this morning are Dr. Buell Januzzi. He is the director of the Stewart Observatory and the department head in astronomy. And Dr. Ewan McLeod, he is the associate professor and associate professor of optical sciences in the Optical Sciences College. And so we're talking about Dr. McLeod, you're in the nanosphere. You're looking at small stuff, and you're kind of in the astronomy is kind of looking at the big stuff out in the big picture. But it comes together under this umbrella of optics, of how important it is to be able to see what we're talking about and to look and view the things that we are hypothesizing and thinking about, and then be able to develop the tools to be able to see what we've thought about. And so astronomy is a good example. We've talked about black holes for a long time, and we finally got to see probably with one of your mirrors the ability to see at least the edge of a black hole.
So actually the U of A was very critically involved in that work, but that used our radio telescopes an interferometer. Yeah,
but just being able to have the U of A be involved in this technology that is allowing us to see the world and the universe in a way maybe we haven't experienced before. So let's talk a little bit about the future of optical sciences. Where is it headed? Where do you think that in the next 10 years or so, where will your college be looking at in terms of research and some of your colleagues? What's some of the earth-shattering, landmark things that might be happening in the next few years.
So, I mean, I think that the College of Optical Sciences works closely with the Mirror Lab and with Buell. So I think that's, I mean, one of the biggest advantages U of A has over anywhere. I mean, we make the biggest mirrors in the world. And so I think there's a lot of opportunities to kind of push that technology, kind of measure the mirrors, make smoother surfaces on the mirrors, these sorts of things, and know better about that sort of ability to fabricate something that's kind of very big but perfect at the really, really tiny scale. That's one area. I mean, another area I think is improving kind of photonics. So that's improving data communications, data transfer, making that more energy efficient so that you can send more data with consuming less power. There's also a lot of opportunity for breakthroughs in quantum optics. So that's kind of a big hot topic now. And so I think that's going to continue to become kind of a bigger and bigger research area for people. So the idea is quantum optics begins to become interesting when you think of the idea of single photons. So a lot of times if you think of light, you can think of it as just like a stream of light that's hitting, you know, your camera, your eyes or something like this. But once you get down to the level of sensitivity of single photons, there's these quantum mechanical effects and interactions and quantum entanglement and so on that become interesting and can enable more sensitive devices, enable more secure communication, these sorts of things.
That's interesting, yeah. They talk about a photon from the sun bouncing around in there maybe 10 million years before it accidentally sneaks to the surface and then takes off and heads 8 minutes later to the back of your hand on Earth. It's amazing that
You remember your astronomy really well.
It's amazing that these photons, it's amazing. They're little worlds unto themselves, and it's interesting if you can capture some of that energy and some of that. It is great. What's the future look like for astronomy as we move into the next 50 years or so? What do you think is going to be something major that we do?
Well, I think one of the most exciting common topics that I think the whole planet is looking forward to is the search for signs of life on planets around other stars.
Right.
And the generation of giant telescopes that are being built right now on the ground and will be built in space in the next 20 to 25 years are our best shot ever at seeing signs of life, how life is influencing their own planet in a way that's compelling and convincing. The first 10 times you're going to hear of life being discovered, it'll turn out that an astronomer gets too excited and says, "We found a sign of life," and then some chemist is going to say, "Wait a second, that could be done some other way."
Right, that's not really life,
But when I was in grad school in the 80s, I wouldn't have dreamed of being able to image a planet next to another star. And our colleagues at the university, Laird Close and others, just released last week the first images of a planet forming. You can actually see evidence of material falling onto the planet as it clears out a lane of dust around two rings around the parent star. So you should get Laird to come and talk about that. But that only could happen because of the Large Binocular Telescope and the Magellan 6.5-meter telescopes that the U of A helped build in Arizona and in Chile. And those telescopes are small compared to what's coming.
Right. And the bigger it gets, the more resolution we have and the more finite the
that's right.
And even in the last 40 years, discovering planets around stars, we guessed they were there, and now we've seen them.
Now we can take pictures of them.
Yeah, it's kind
but
of
they're still little dots.
Yeah, so it's going to have even higher resolution.
That's
maybe some of this photon technology that he's talking about will help us.
So for us, the kind of manipulating and 3D printing things that Ewan does raises the possibility of making new kinds of electronics and things that are smaller.
That's great.
New instruments.
Wonderful. Well, we want to thank you both for the wonder that you bring to the University of Arizona. And what's one thing that you think is wonder at the U of A besides your department?
So for me, it's our students.
Oh, I love it. Yeah.
They come in wanting to do new things.
That's
it's
great.
It's our job to help them do that.
How about you? What's one thing that's one? Your wife. Yeah.
My wife. But yeah, no, I'm always very impressed by planetary sciences at the U of A.
That's cool.
I don't do a lot of stuff related to that, but I think that's kind of
that's great. Well, thank you both very much, and thanks for being here on The Morning Voice. That's Wonder from the University of Arizona. A great discussion about optics and how that affects us in our daily lives. We'll be back next week, and on Monday, Lydia will be here with Rainmakers. You're listening to The Morning Voice.